Okay, I'm going to discuss manners both as the basic amenities of a civilized life, but primarily as those focused and punctilious performances which a traditional society such as our Southland practices with care and precision. To the outsider, they look like some sort of ritual, and indeed they are. Only I think it's better to call them liturgies, a word that derives from two Greek stems, meaning work of the people. Or better, or perhaps more clearly, a work which constitutes a people, which comprises them, makes them up, makes them noticeable. A Christian gathering, for instance, is turned into the corporate body of Christ by the acts of confession, the liturgy of confession, joy and song, prayer, the Eucharist, so forth. But whereas the Christian liturgy transforms the gathering into a mystical body, the mystical body of Christ, the amenities and the rituals of our manners, among other things, render us a pilgrim people, a body still bound by time, with a long and arduous journey yet to fulfill. Big words. Don't let my humble title, Southern Manners, fool you. It is a major theme in Southern studies, which is made very difficult by the following. Those who are vigilant in Southern manners simply enact them. They don't discuss them, nor do they explain the reasons for doing so. You ask a well-mannered Southerner, why do you do that? You'll get silence. Say, any talking head, let's say Bill Moyers, stuck a microphone into my grandmother's mouth. My grandmother was named Mam-Am, and I will two of them. Not one, two, ma'ams, ma'am. Stuck into ma'am's face a microphone and ask why she just told me to make sure that my company, some of you will remember when we're talking about manners, suddenly your friends become your company. Not your friends, not your buddies, company. You know you're on to serious talk at that point. That your company must use the front door when they enter and leave, never the kitchen door or the back door or any other door. She simply wouldn't answer him. She might mumble those dreaded words, lowborn. But to stop and explain a reason for her command would have been unthinkable. For the child, the great mystery of the command completely and instantly warranted its authority. Now, the talking head would have been delighted to learn that what is behind this command is simply a vision, a mystery. It's simply done. This is what's behind Mam-Am's command. How quaint. A society that still lives by mythology. How quaint. Can you imagine that? The front door, if I can proceed into Mam-Am's command, is the veil between public and private worlds, a veil which has been rent in our time, as we've been talking about here, the encroachment of the public world upon the private, and toward the end of my talk, I'll give some other examples of that. But it's a veil between the public and the private worlds. Mam-Am didn't think about the symbolism. She simply lived, as it were, the entire poem, which is the master, of which the veil of the front door is the master image. What she simply knew in the command is that I must learn that there are two distinct worlds in my life, and that learning how to comport myself in each one, and above all, how to manage how to balance the transition from one into the other through that door, were lessons that if I did not learn, my life would eventually fall into ruin. The poem was hers, its vision was hers, and she knew by tradition, blood, upbringing, and practice what the great Dante taught, that Canto 28 to Paradiso, lines 110 through 112, that blessedness depends on vision. Living a happy life depends on vision. Making it all the way through depends on vision. That, to continue with Dante, that the measure of vision lies in merit, that the extent to which I have understood and lived into the mystery and the vision is the measure of my merit, that I mind my manners, and that love, the highest of the Christian virtues, is the reward. Can't start with love. Beatles notwithstanding, love's not all you need. You have to learn to see right. This is us. This is our liturgy. You must walk into a vision, walk into a poem, go through that veil, come back through that veil, back and forth. And you'll behave well, and love will be the gift. Love is the highest of the Christian virtues, faith, hope, and love. As she loved us, so she taught us and commanded us how to see. Act well and encounter love. In a very real sense, her command was meant to save us, and I mean that. In a very real sense, Mam's command was meant to save us. So, I have a problem in this address that Mam didn't explain. Not just Mam, Faulkner's mother had a sign over her kitchen window. Anybody know what it says, other than Jim Kibler? Jim, do you know what it said? Don't explain, don't complain. So they don't tell us why. The talking head, as I said, would be delighted by symbolism, verse, mystery, and vision, but he still wants a reason. As does the Sunday evening TV audience. Indeed, why start with command for proper behavior? Why not simply teach? You can give a story if you want, but teach the reason about comportment in public and private worlds. Simply give the reason. Let me give you another example and change the manner, not the manner of going in and out of your house with your company, but another of those large punctilious mannerisms we practice. This past fall, the Jefferson Scholars were hosting a breakfast for alumni donors to the university. And as the old friends gathered in the dining hall, I witnessed all the plain old greetings. I witnessed what the talking heads want, just greetings, friendliness, the cooings, the fierce hugs, the back slapping, but not these strange rituals. Until a group of friends took seats at a table, and there was one seat left. And a lady none of this company knew approached. Now, before she could ask permission, that's important for my talk, before she could ask permission to sit down, one man, and I'm choosing this for this one of the reasons I'm choosing this example, because he was the only Southerner in the group. He was from North Carolina. Without having to ask, this North Carolinian was at his feet, and like a matador leaning into his extended cape, he held her chair with grace and humility. Now, Dante said in his unfinished philosophical treatise, he was trying his hand at philosophy before he went on into the comedy. He said in the Convivio, I think the best definition of grace that there is, he said, it's coming to the aid and welcome of another unasked. If you have to ask, it's all ruined. You have to do it before it's asked for. Coming to the aid and welcome of another unasked. And this act of the North Carolinian was grace. The lady stranger was instantly part of the happy company. Grace is not simply greeting or welcome. It arrives on its own. And so, to use another connotation of the Latin gratia, which we get grace, take another connotation of gratia, it is simply gratuitous. As you don't wait to be asked, so you never give a reason. You just do it. And that invites you into a different vision, different poem, and she was instantly part of this happy company from the class of 75, I believe it was. Try to reason this out. Try to reason it. Come on, ma'am, you can always give a good reason. That's what's really at the foundation of all this, isn't it? Try to reason it out and you'll contradict yourself. Watch this. St. Paul, in his Philippians letter, chapter 2, verses 6 through 11, some of you might already know the letter, chapter, and verse at this point, says that, quote unquote, the mind of Christ was, the mind of Christ, he's telling us what the mind of Christ is, that though he was equal to God, he did not see his equality to be something to grasp at. It's hard verb to translate, but grasp at, hold on to, cling to. Did not see that his equality was something to be grasped at. We can paraphrase, he was at home in the fellowship of the Holy Trinity, but it was nothing to be grasped at. So he put his equality aside and came quickly to become a man and humbly, as it were, hold our chair to the great banquet table. Parenthetically, Philippians 2, 6 through 11, as you might know, is an ancient hymn. As Paul is writing to this church at Philippi, he suddenly, to make an emphasis on what he's saying, he simply starts quoting an ancient hymn. It's nowhere written down, as far as we know, except in Paul's letter here. So it's very early. Paul's writings are the very earliest in the New Testament. They're earlier than the Gospels. The earliest letter, somewhere being 45 A.D., is a good assessment. So this is very, very early. And he's giving us the mind of Christ, an old hymn that this small body of Christians in Philippi sang. Christ performed the work of God by giving up his equality to God, reasonably. That is a contradiction. All that one can really do with an example such as this is to talk along the lines of the verse, the hymn, the vision, the mystery, the way we did with the front door symbol. You need to deal with the vision, which again, Dante said, comes merit and finally love. But answering a rationalist demand with symbols is like handing Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens one of St. Anselm's prayers to analyze. You can laugh if you want. That's Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins being this group that journalists call the New Atheists. They're supposed to be such a threat to the Christian faith. St. Anselm's prayer being the so-called proof for the existence of God. That's what Kant called it. He called it the ontological proof for the existence of God. Anselm called it a prayer, in which he shows how faith seeks understanding and can understand. So if you read Richard Dawkins' account of Anselm's prayer, you can see he just stumbles over it, falls flat on his face, and to make it through, he cheats. I've seen students get kicked out of school for less. He cheats. I'll tell you what he does. And I'll tell you why he's suddenly reading a powerful thinker on Anselm's text. And he skews intentionally the text. We can talk about that afterwards. He can't handle it. It makes no sense to him because it's a prayer. We are dealing with two completely different worlds in this discussion. Let me be clear. I'm not talking about the private and the public world here. I'm talking about the world of manners and the world where manners are just strange, gratuitous gestures that make no sense whatsoever. Those are the two worlds I'm talking about, not Mam's two worlds of the public and the private. Okay. There are two worlds in each case, and I simply have to call them two worlds. To analyze the difference between these worlds in this discussion, let me refer to one of the South's great poets and literary critics who's already been brought to this podium in this summer session, John Crow Ransom, who taught. He was the professor for many of the contributors to I'll Take My Stand. Ransom identifies two modes of human endeavor. What he calls work forms and play forms. The work forms include all activities necessary for our physical and economic well-being. Those are the work forms. Their validity is measured by a strict standard of efficiency. The play forms, however, are gloriously inefficient, quote unquote. It is our play, especially our art, manners, and religion. For us, will manners, art, and religion, that are uniquely human. All animals make provision for their physical comfort. Only human beings enjoy the aesthetic life. Ransom insists that life is defined by its forms rather than by its ends. A man solely interested in possessing a woman, this is to use an example of Ransom's, a man consumed with possessing a woman is better advised simply to ravish her on the spot than to participate in the elaborate rituals of courtship. But it is only through those rituals that he can come to know her as a human being rather than as a mere object of lust. There's something cognitive in manners. The difference between a savage and a gentleman is really the difference between two kinds of individualism. To quote Ransom, one is greedy and bogus, accounting only to egoism. The other is contemplative, genuine, and philosophical. The function of a code of manners is to make us capable of something better than the stupidity of an appetitive or merely economic life. End quote. Ransom believed that there was a fundamental ontological unity between art, manners, and religion. Making precisely this point, he writes, quote, "We accept or refuse the arts with their complex intention, according as we like or dislike the fruits, or it may be the flowers they bring to us. But these arts and their techniques may be always reinforced by the examples of manners and religion. The three institutions do not rest on three foundations, but on one foundation. A natural affiliation binds together the gentleman, the religious man, and the artist. Punctilious characters, all of them, in their formalism." Regarding the manners of courtship again, Ransom further writes, "Manners require of us that the object be known." There's that cognitive, epistemological role in the well-mannered life. Love, no doubt, to continue my quotation, love, respect, tenderness, grace, and a fixation upon the object All these terms do define an attitude in subjective and emotional terms. But they mean nothing. They mean nothing to us until we study what we are really trying to do with the object. We are trying to know it as a complete individual object and to protect it against others and the predatory kind of knowledge which would reduce it to mere utility. End quote. An interest in utility asks for a reason. Why would you do that? You know, to the mannered person. Why do you do that? Don't stand on ceremony. What good does it do? Manners wants to live by grace, by gratuity, by wanting to know, to behold, to see, to protect, and to love. Walker Percy, one of our great Southern writers, and earlier in his life, a great scientist in college and medical school, and then a brief medical practice before he gave it all up to become a fiction writer, says in absolute frustration, he says, our whole culture simply doesn't understand that the sciences will not tell us anything about what something is. All scientists know what they do. Non-scientists don't know. All scientists know. They never tell us what something is. They'd simply tell us the characteristics that it shares with all other things. They never say what something is. No, it's art, manners, and religion, for our concern is manners, that tell us what something is. If you want to know a lady, practice your manners. If you don't, you're going to treat her as an object of lust. So we're dealing with two completely different worlds in this discussion, and to analyze them further, I got out of place. Just to give you an example, Sonnet 73, Shakespeare, many of you know these lines. That time of year that mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves or none and few do hang, upon the boughs that strike against the cold, bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet bird sang. Read them again to yourself. 73 Sonnet. You're beholding a tree. You're seeing a tree for what it is. Not simply all the characteristics that it shares, whether it be a sequoia or a palmetto. You're looking at a tree. You're beholding what a tree is. Bare ruined choirs where late the sweet bird sang. You're beholding worlds in the front door. And God in the one who rises to greet you, even if you are a stranger. One who comes low to welcome you, the table of the kingdom, if you are too proud to desire it. Cheers. For the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume, manners in each world, the one of the direct approach of power and the other of the indirect approach of manners, art, and worship, could never be reconciled, never. There's no way to reconcile, can't smooth the difference over. In one of his great essays, which is called The Rise of the Arts and Sciences, which I advise all of you to read at some point, it's got a lot to do. With many things, manners is simply one of them, and not the main thing. But he does write this about manners. Wherever nature has given the mind a propensity to any vice or to any passion, disagreeable to others, refined breeding has taught man to throw the bias on the opposite side and to preserve in all their behavior the appearance of sentiment different from those to which they would naturally incline. To continue with Hume, we must either condemn this as foppish, and affected, or simply admit of gallantry. Two choices. Bad English. One choice. Foppish, gallantry. Which one's it going to be? They're irreconcilable. The one that would call it foppish is the world of Thomas Hobbes. a thinker we have discussed often. In his classic text, Leviathan of 1651, often in these summer sessions, and in this summer session as well, by several of us, in his classic text of 1651, the Leviathan, Hobbes held that in the original state of nature, quote, our felicity is a continual progress of desire from one object to another. The attaining of the former being but the way to the latter. The object of desire is not to enjoy once only, but to ensure enjoyment forever. The general inclination of mankind is a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceases only at death. This is the man from Merrill Lynch that Vince Graham told us about in his great lecture the other night. He lives in that world. He almost says the exact same thing. Now, in Hobbes's view, to cancel the fear and the possibility of violent or untimely death, end quote, which, of course, is going to happen in a world of such desire. Civil society, untimely death. Humanity makes a contract to form civil society. Civil society is not an attempt to soften or refine power or to behold the world. Rather, it is simply a result of each man, quote, each man laying down his right to all things and be contented with so much liberty against another man as would allow either man against himself. In other words, I allow Joe over here as much pursuit of through power as will allow for my pursuit of power, and then we contract that out to the whole body. Hobbes is the father of us all, Marx said, and it is clear that for him manners can be only foppery or design by stealth upon another, you know, suck somebody into your machinations. Hobbes's world, just to be clear, is that world which Dr. Livingston simply called the Lincolnian world. The other world is the world, as we have seen, of the alternative world is the world of Aristotle, Althusius, St. Thomas, Thomas Jefferson, and many others. John C. Calhoun, of course. Politics comprised of natural associations, such as families, with Mam-Mam at the lead, overlapping families called villages, neighborhoods, parishes, universities, neighborhoods, and on and on. The network of natural affiliations, John Calhoun simply called constitution, which is prior to government and is the source of the constraint upon government and which may secede from government when in the course of human events it becomes necessary to dissolve political bands. Thomas Jefferson. There is no isolate in a state of nature. Outside of the community, one is either a madman or a god, as one of us said this week, which is again from Aristotle's Politics. Humanity, in this view, accordingly, has no fixed state of nature, but rather is a story of developing historic communities in which men and women acquire the practices that perfect them as social creatures. Morally, these practices are called virtues, from the Latin vir, weir or vir, whichever. If you learn church Latin, it's one. If you learn classical Latin, it's the other. But it means man. These are the habits, routines, liturgies that make us men. Last year, I tried to show how this development into full humanity takes place over time by tracing the course from the virtue of prudence, then to moderation, then to courage, and finally to justice, the four classical virtues according to the classical world, which make us men and women. I will not repeat that journey now, except to repeat that the goal of this rigor is honor. Honor is the completion of virtue. It is full belonging, making it to the end, the blessed life, as I put it earlier. It is full belonging, a blessing which is to be reveled in. It is completely benevolent, fearless, and to be protected at all costs. The vices wear it away. For the vices wear it away. And shame collapses it instantly. For shame is exile. So I reminded everybody last summer, I'll do so again, when you read Faulkner, you learn that you must never feel shame. That's the complete collapse of honor. You must, when you do bad things, you simply regret them because they're not worthy of you. So regret, never feel shame. Shame is a deadly thing. Now I would like to argue that these special amenities and performances we've been discussing, which we call manners, in such a traditional society, are small moments of honorings along the way to the goal of honor. The gratuitous gestures of standing like a Tar Heel when a stranger approaches, or writing thank you notes after the thanks have already been verbally acknowledged, holding doors for women and for men, addressing a stranger of whatever station in life, sir or ma'am, refusing to wear your bowling clothes at church. Sorry about that, but I mean it. Are each one moments of regarding each other as if the final state of honor has already been reached, whether this be in the private world of home or the public world beyond the front door, each with its own severe routines while life lasts. To give you an example of what I'm talking about, again, Dante, who's my figure here. Dante nails this vision in his Paradiso. Read the Paradiso. I ask my students every year when I teach Paradiso in the fall, how many have read Inferno? A couple hands go up. How many have read Purgatorio? Fewer hands go up. How many have read Paradiso? None. Why? Why don't you want the good news? I mean, what if heaven were really like holding hands with your beloved and flying to heaven? You don't want to read that. It's really something weird with us that we don't read that. Anyway, so it's a story of a flight path to God along the planets of the solar system, or the known planets along the solar system, each one representing a virtue, a lesson, and metaphors of charity on one, contemplation on another, being a warrior for God on another, justice on another, and so forth, which must be encountered and embraced by the mind, heart, and will before one can encounter God. But on each planet are well-mannered soul lights, lights of souls who have passed on to the higher life, who are there to help the Dantes along the way. And the manners are those moments of honorings along the way to the final honor. On the first rung, for instance, on the first rung of these planetary orbits, Dante the Pilgrim finds the lowly maiden, a lonely maiden he knew in Florence. Her name is Picarda. Dante, not sufficiently salted yet with heavenly grace, asks a Hobbesian question. He knew what was coming. Don't you want to be higher up the scale? Why are you so happy here? Picard's answer, long story short, is that all souls are in equal standing in the highest heaven. They are fanned out in a downward motion in this hierarchy of planetary graces. Hierarchy means holy order. It does not mean pecking order. Hieros, Greek. Holy order. We just assume hierarchy, you know, pecking order. That's all there is. You know, don't you want to be higher? Don't you want more, you know, don't you want a higher degree? Fanned out downward in this hierarchy, holy order, to greet him, to guide him, to hold his chair as he prepares for the final banquet of honor. In other words, they gave up their equal being in God, they knew the Philippian letter. And we'll return there with him at journey's end along the way when all the virtues have been acquired. And what does Dante see at journey's end? He sees the soul lights now all back in the highest heaven, straight into the blinding, who bid him stare straight into the blinding light of God. As his eyes adjust, he can barely make out three circles, and lo and behold, cognitive category. Lo and behold, he makes it out that the central circle bears our effigy. Dante, God in the end honors us. He comes to greet us unasked. Indeed, the whole comedy is grace coming unasked, because in Inferno 2, not right at the beginning, but Inferno 2, when Virgil tells Dante Pilgrim that to rid himself of sin, he will need to visit all the neighborhoods of the Christian afterlife, hell, purgatory, and heaven, Dante falters and lets Virgil know that in no uncertain terms, he is a coward. He says, I'm not Aeneas, and I'm not St. Paul. One man who withstood a journey into the classical afterlife, and a missionary who claimed to have been translated, this is in 2 Corinthians, claimed to have been translated briefly into the highest heaven. Yeah, I'm a chicken. I can't do that stuff. Virgil then tells him that his beloved in Florence, Beatrice Portinari, who died at age, well, we think around age 20, saw from her height in heaven her friend's sorrow and his fear in sin, and gave up her place in heaven to hike through hell to ask Virgil to find him. So here at the beginning of the journey is a visitation unasked and a command, a movement away from the comforts of the sofa to go down and honor a youth she once knew. Dante gathers his courage instantly and is on his way. I have a student who is from Dallas, and never encountered anything like this. And not that that's Dallas, I don't mean that. She personally had never encountered anything like this before. And as I was trying to help her out with a paper, I was talking about conversations that Dante and Beatrice have. And all of a sudden she looked at me and said, Mr. Wilson, she said, if my boyfriend does not talk to me the way Dante talked to Beatrice, he's out the door. Never heard language like this in her life. out the door. Bye-bye. It is not simply by chance that the greatest Christian vision, mystery, story, poem of all times is a perfect rendition of the nature of manners and honor. The persistence of manners in the South, in the South is perfect evidence that the faith's hold on our region is still intact. When Flannery O'Connor was asked for the reason that there are so many freaks in Southern literature, she answered by saying, quote, because we can still identify a freak when we see one. Southerners today readily admit that our region does not practice the manners as carefully and consistently as it should, or perhaps it did in my grandmother's day, but like freaks, we still know bad manners when we see them. There is no doubt in my mind that our adherence to manners is a primary reason we have resisted wanting to, quote unquote, look like the nations. That fatal downfall of Israel, recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 8. I didn't look it up. I'm pretty sure where Israel goes to Samuel and says, we want to look like the nations. We don't want to look like the nations. That was the beginning of the end. It really is. That's the beginning of the end in Hebrew scripture. We don't want to look like the nations. One reason for this, of course, is simply that, as Hank Williams Jr. taught us all to say, we say, sir, We say ma'am, and if you don't like it, we don't give a damn. But the main reason is a little more Christian. Not that that's not a Christian statement, but a little more. And that's still good Christian advice. Somebody cite me the chapter and verse. Our own reason is Christian. Our own historic liturgy comes first. Our faith tells us that every person's true identity is hidden in God, coram Deo. We are all simul justus et peccator, at the same time, sinners and saved. That's just not a Lutheran tag. There's more, you know, Easterners and Romans have more to say about it, but that's something which Christians of all stripes will accept. Simul justus et peccator, at once sinners and saved. And so all people must be honored. The grace shed upon us in the faith is an incomprehensible honoring of humanity on its way to God. It is an expression of his esteem and a great distinction. Our mannerly acts of honoring must be given to all people, stranger and friend, young and old, black and white, rich and poor. We don't ask, and we do it unasked. I would like to close. I have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to close by giving some examples of the way in which I have learned to understand manners simply by encountering mannerly or ill-mannered activities. In my own lifetime, one comes from teaching William Faulkner, struggling with William Faulkner as a young man and teaching him for many years afterwards. There's a scene in Faulkner's great story, The Bear, which is in his wonderful novel, Go Down Moses. And it's a scene, the setting is 1880. The scene of this story, The Bear, is in the 1880s, and a young black man suddenly appears at the home of the plantation master. He has been seeing a young black woman who lives on the plantation and is there to take her away, as the young woman has just come in to her inheritance. The black man is assertive when he encounters the plantation master. And in the midst of the encounter, the master says, "You don't say sir to me?" And the young man responds, "I say sir to my betters." Students love this. 1880s, search your rights. Yeah. Miss the point entirely. Because this is where Faulkner, you know, he sticks his chin out. Give me a, you know. Makes it hard. If you're going to read this novel, you're going to learn my ways, is what he's doing, right? You're going to learn my ways or the novel's not going to make any sense. And if you try to explain it, you'll make a fool of yourself, just like the new atheist on an 11th century prayer. 10th century prayer, sorry. But because then in the next scene, a man from the plantation family goes to check up on the young woman and finds her living in a throwed-out farm, a complete hovel, no arable land, no stock, no stove wood. I don't even believe there's a barn. And the man from the plantation simply says, "How do you plan on taking care of her?" And he simply responds by saying that he's free, that the South is the new Canaan. Faulkner can make it tough. The South is the new Canaan. The man wears lensless glasses. Here's the only help Faulkner gives you. He wears lensless glasses. His dignity is a complete self-deception. He doesn't know the transition from the private world to the public world. He doesn't know what a private world is. He should have said sir to the plantation master because he was in his home. Say it to anybody, black, white, young, old, rich, poor. Should have said. And that's a sign that he does not know privacy. And so he has no private life whatsoever. What he has are rights, a woman, and a shack. No privacy. No private life at all. It's not balanced by the public world. His dignity is phony. Faulkner can be very hard. In terms of our discussion today, as I said, now his privacy, this is one of those sequences in Faulkner's narratives where he simply seems not to know where he is going. He seems to be praising the man at first for the courage to assert his rights, and then scold him for self-deception at the expense of his lady. But Faulkner is simply writing for his people, whom he knows can follow his lead because they know his ways. And he offers no help to the outsider critic. Mam gives no answer, no reason, gives them no help whatsoever. To the critics who cannot connect the scenes, the critic will talk about one scene and then the other, but never the two together, though they follow hard upon the other. And if you know what Faulkner is doing, you will see that the one or two critics who have actually tried to talk about both scenes together look like fools. Andrew Lytle, one of our great writers, is great for this scene from Faulkner. In his wonderful novel, which nobody reads, called A Name for Evil. Read it. Lytle was really, he wasn't Faulkner, but he was a great Southern writer. Really great. And in this novel, he has the same sort of thing going on. He has a man, and it's himself. He's scolding himself. He was the longest living and the last of the agrarians. And at some point in his life, midlife, he decides to really do it right. He's going to throw it all away, and he's going to go back and live on the land. He's going to be a farmer. And so he buys a throwed-out farm, and it costs him all of his capital, all of his time, all of his strength, and all of his time that must be spent with his wife in order to get this farm in shipshape. He wants to drag it out of the ground all by himself. He suddenly, in an error, and Lytle's writing about himself, I know that, because I met him, he thought that by himself he could go back into the past and create Eden. That was a big error on his part. And you can see, the first time you really begin to see the error is when he and his wife go to bed, and there's wallpaper torn on the wall, and there's scrawlings from people who had been in the throwed-out farm, and they write dirty words and all this kind of stuff. And he gets into bed with his wife. There's not a soul for miles around. They're in the middle of no place on the Kentucky-Tennessee border. And he gets in bed with his wife and starts to snuggle in. And she turns around and says, "Not now, dear. We have no privacy." So privacy is just not being alone. He had forgotten what the private world really means. It's a tragic story. I'll let you read it. So you follow that? Those are two examples of my trying to master some beautiful fiction, where they don't make it easy on us. They expect us to know the Southern ways. The last example, I've got a few minutes, comes from my own life. I had a seminar teacher at Harvard. It was a course in the philosophy department taught by a man. I won't tell you his name. The course was on German idealism, and he invited the seminar over to his house for dinner, supper. And so I walked from my dorm to the man's house, and I came at the same time to the front door with a good friend, another North Carolinian. This fellow was from Wake Forest, not the college, but from the town. And we knocked on the door, and the man met us, and he looked at my friend, who did not have a tie on. "Just wait." And he said, "Well, Mr. Jones, my wife requires a tie at her table." And he paused, and he said, "Oh, come in." And of course, my friend had a perfectly humiliating meal there. I went home. I'll tell you the aftermath when we were walking back to the dorm together. But a week or two later, I was on the phone with my father, who was a Charlestonian of fine manners because his mother was Mam-Mam. And I told him this story, and he said without missing a beat, he said, a real gentleman would have taken his tie off. Without missing a beat, a real gentleman would have taken his tie off. The guy's a phony. Dad didn't say the guy's a phony, but he would have said. In other words, you're making that transition. And you can tell a student many things about the way you have to act simply on authority on the yonder side of that front door. I want the paper to look like this. I want you not to speak. As one of my teachers up there said, I don't want to hear any student speak for the rest of the semester. You know, you can get away with that stuff. But coming in the front door, it all changes. It all changes. As Mam-Mam said, that is your company. And he didn't learn the lesson. Well, anyway, walking back, I'm finished now, walking back to the dorm, I asked my friend who knew what I knew, and I said, John, why didn't you wear a tie? And he said, Bill, I thought it was a cookout. And I said, John, can you imagine Professor X hosting an oyster roast or a barbecue? Thank you.